This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Was there ever a time when you thought you were going to die because of an accident, an illness, a stupid risk you took, an assault, or a stranger who seemed on the verge of attacking you? My guest Maggie O'Farrell writes about her 17 brushes with death in her new memoir, I Am, I Am, I Am. That's a lot of brushes with death. Among those experiences and illnesses that nearly killed her are childhood encephalitis, being robbed with a machete held to her neck, nearly drowning after jumping off a harbor wall into the water, amoebic dysentery while traveling, and nearly bleeding out in labor with her first child. Her memoir ends with a chapter about her daughter, who was born with life-threatening eczema and food allergies and has been hospitalized many times. O'Farrell is a novelist. This is her first memoir. She was born in Northern Ireland in 1972 and now lives in Edinburgh, Scotland. Maggie O'Farrell, welcome to Fresh Air. The first story in your book is a story I think a lot of women will relate to. And it's about that moment when you realize a man you suspect might be following you with bad intentions is actually following you with bad intentions. This happened when you were working at a holistic alternative retreat at the base of a mountain. You were you a teenager in your early 20s?
I was 18.
18, okay. And your job at this retreat was cleaning and serving food. I want you to read the first couple of paragraphs from this autobiographical story that opens your new book.
On the path ahead, stepping out from behind a boulder, a man appears. We are, he and I, on the far side of a dark tarn that lies hidden in the bowl-curved summit of this mountain. The sky is a milky blue above us. No vegetation grows this far up, so it is just me and him, the stones and a still black water. He straddles the narrow track with both booted feet, and he smiles. I realise several things, that I passed him earlier, further down the glen. We greeted each other in the amiable yet brief manner of those on a country walk. That on this remote stretch of path there is no one near enough to hear me call. That he has been waiting for me. He has planned this whole thing carefully, meticulously, and I have walked into his trap. I see all this in an instant.
You know, so many of us have gone through this. There's this moment where you don't know if you're being paranoid or rude about this man who you think has bad intentions. What made you realize that you were in trouble?
Well, I think it's an instinct that actually all women have developed or have to develop, unfortunately, probably from quite a young age. You know, I tell this to my own kids, you know, if you think something isn't right, there's a good chance it isn't right. You know, and I think in that instant, it's very important to follow your instinct, not to tell yourself it's going to be all right. And if you feel it isn't, something isn't as it should be, then you need to get out of there as fast as you can.
So this man did not actually attack you, but he did do something that was very creepy and frightening and threatening. Would you describe what that was?
Well, I was on this walk, as I said, and I realized that I'd seen him further down the valley, and I still don't know how he got ahead of me to intercept me on the way up. And so I walked past him, and then he came after me, and he said he wanted to show me a bird on the lake, and so he put his binocular strap around my neck. And I knew as everybody does, that it wasn't right, that it wasn't true, it wasn't just about the bird, and I knew he meant to harm me. So I talked my way out of it. I just ducked out under the binocular strap and I talked to him and I kept him talking and I asked him about the birds and I knew that the only way I could save myself, because he was a lot bigger than me and he was a lot stronger than me, and I knew the only way to get out of there was to use my brain instead, I suppose.
So you got safely back and you went to the police. You told them about this man and you told them that you knew he was going to harm another woman.
I said that I did something not right about it. There was not right about the situation that I wanted them to know.
And they were very dismissive. But then later, two other police officers came.
Yeah.
And what did they tell you?
Well, they didn't tell me anything, but they asked me about the incident in very close detail, and then they asked me to look at some photographs and to say if I saw the person with the binoculars among these photographs, which I did, and I pointed him out. And I knew what had happened. I could sense it, and I said to them, he has killed someone, hasn't he? And they wouldn't tell me anything. But then a few days later, I read in the newspaper that a girl had been killed, that she'd been raped and then strangled and then buried not very far from where I had been walking.
Was she strangled with the binocular strap that he tried to put around your neck?
It's impossible to say because the article didn't say that and the police wouldn't confirm it, and they never got in touch with me again to testify. And actually, I left the area very soon afterwards. And the strangest thing is, I think, you know, all this happened in a time when, you know, it was pre-internet. And, you know, so I actually never found out what happened. All I know is what I've said.
You wrote that you think all the time about this woman who was murdered. She was 22. What do you think about when you think about her murder?
I know that it could have been me. And I know there's not really any reason why it was her instead of me. It's just chance. And I think also writing that piece, because it isn't a story I ever told anyone. The only person I ever told about it was the man who I eventually married. And I never told my family, I never told my friends. I didn't want to talk about it at all. It was something I completely buried. And I think looking back on it, I felt a certain amount of guilt, perhaps, over the other girl that I never really admitted or explored to myself. But certainly writing about it was, it made me realise that there's a kind of sense of ownership over stories. You know, I don't really own the story. The real nub of the story, the trauma of the story, belongs to the other girl, not to me. You know, I'm just a footnote in this narrative. You know, the story is hers. And I wrote it in such a way, very carefully. I mean, in a kind of technical sense, it was tricky to write because I was determined not to identify where it happened, because the very, very last thing I wanted to do was to make it identifiable to that girl's family, you know, because there isn't. I cannot think of a worse way to die than she died. There isn't really a worse way to die, you know, in the fear and agony and terror she must have been feeling at that time. And I think literally the very last thing I wanted to do was to add to their pain over what happened, because, you know, how would it feel to them 30 years on to perhaps pick up a book and start reading it and realise that I was describing the situation in which their daughter or sister or friend died. I have a responsibility not to add to their pain and not to make it identifiable, and also not to let them realise that it could have been somebody else, because how would that help them?
Mm-hmm. One of your first brushes with death was when you were 8 and were diagnosed with encephalitis, which is a virus that attacks the nervous system. So what did it attack in your body?
Well, the first thing I knew about it was waking up one morning when I was 8 years old. It was just at the end of the summer holidays. I was just about to go back to school. And I woke up with an astonishingly bad headache. I mean, so bad I was sort of almost hallucinating. You know, the room around me felt as though it was in technicolor, and it was as if the walls were moving. So I had a very high fever and this terrible headache. And then a few days later, I started to lose motor control in my hands, first of all. So any kind of fine motion, like picking up a glass or a toothbrush or a pencil, being able to write, I began to lose control of my hands. And I remember saying to my mum, I was trying to pick up something on the sink, and my hand just kept hitting the wall and then coming back and hitting the wall. And I remember calling my mum and saying, look at this, look, do you see what's happening? And I just remember her face as she stood in the bathroom doorway, and I thought, oh, this isn't good news. And the doctor came to see me later that day. He came to the house, and as I came down the stairs, I realised that my legs were going as well, and my head was wobbling on my neck. And By the time I reached the bottom of the stairs, the doctor was watching me walk down. He said to my mother, "You have to take her to hospital right now." And so I think the virus had attacked my cerebellum, which is the part of the brain tucked in right at the top of the spine. And it governs, well, it mostly is involved in movement, sort of large and small motor control, in balance, and in, I think, various other things, both psychological and physical, but those are its main functions.
You were told that you would never walk again. The doctors who told you that were wrong, but when you were told that, what did you see ahead for yourself?
To be honest, I think the thing that I'd heard which was worse was that I was going to die, and I did hear a nurse say that outside my room, so I knew that it was true. And I think also, you know, as a child, nobody tells you things, you know, all the conversation about you and your illness and your symptoms and your prospects are all done elsewhere, you know, they're all told to your parents when you're not in the room. So you have to become this person who picks up on things. You've got to look at your the facial expressions of the people looking after you, your parents and the nurses and the doctors. You've got to try and interpret the silences around you and what people are saying and what they're not saying. And so hearing from this nurse in the corridor who mistakenly let slip that I was expected to die, I think that was the biggest shock to me. You know, when I heard it, I knew it in a sense. It didn't come as a huge shock, but it sort of made everything that was happening around me suddenly made sense. And I thought, oh, of course I'm dying. How did I not realise that? So I think when it was clear that I wasn't going to die and that my fate instead was going to be that I couldn't walk, that felt like an improvement. So the idea that I might not be able to walk felt better than dying, obviously. You know, to an 8-year-old it made, or a 9-year-old, whatever it was at that point. I don't know, it didn't feel quite as bad, obviously, because it isn't. I mean, it isn't quite as bad as dying. I think my main fear was that I would never be alone. I think even as a young child, I quite liked to be on my own, even though I grew up in quite a big, noisy household. And the idea that you're unable to move or walk or be independent, I think that preoccupied my mind quite a lot. So I was very lucky in that some physiotherapists believed that I could be helped. Without them, I wouldn't be ambulatory today. I wouldn't be able to walk or pick up a pen or write or do anything, I think, because the doctors said she isn't going to walk again. You know, she'll need to go to a school for children with, you know, special needs. She won't be able to write. She won't be able to live independently. But the physios said, well, let's give it a go. Let's give her some appointments, see how she gets on. And I am pretty much every day, almost every breath I take, grateful for that, because I did respond to their treatments and I am able to walk. I'm able to hold a pen. I can make my living. I can do the thing that I love most, which is write. All down to them.
So instead of this experience with encephalitis making you feel more vulnerable, it made you more of a risk taker. You did things that were reckless. Why do you think you went in that direction?
Well, I think it could have gone the other way. I think it could have made me into a very cautious person, quite fearful of, you know, taking risks or doing something that might harm me physically, or, you know, maybe picking up some other kind of virus somewhere. But it didn't. It went the opposite way. But I think in a way it was because I feel, you know, I know that those two futures had been mapped out for me. First of all, they said I would die, which is quite something to hear at the age of 8. You know, you couldn't hear that and not be changed by it. And then when I didn't die, they said I wouldn't walk again, that I would lead a life of incapacity. And, you know, so I, for whatever reason, I managed to find a loophole out of both those destinies that were mapped out for me. So I've always felt, really, since then, or I've grown up with this sense that I live this kind of almost charmed existence, that I managed to hoodwink these two paths in life, and that almost that I'm living on borrowed time or extra time. And I've always been really filled with the idea that I must make the most of it.
One of your children, your middle child, was born with severe eczema and allergies. As a baby, her skin would split open if she flexed her wrists or her arms or legs. Mm. She's allergic not only if she eats certain foods, but if she's near someone who is eating certain foods and can go into anaphylaxis. So you have to be constantly vigilant. You have to be the constant protector. So how does that square with your desire to take risks and have adventures?
What I say to my daughter is, it's very important, I think, when you're bringing up a child with additional needs, to stress to them that they are not alone. I mean, this is why I wrote the book. It's dedicated to all my children, but it's really prompted by the experience of parenting a child who lives with a life-threatening medical condition. You know, because as a mother, as a parent, your job when your child goes through something really difficult is to metabolize it for them and to give it back to them in a form that they can understand or comprehend. I think that's been one of the hardest challenges for me as a mother. You know, how do you make it okay for a child who has these repeated near-death experiences? You know, how do you explain to them why they're in pain or why they're in an ICU or on a drip or in an ambulance? You know, it's my job to help her understand what she's going through. And so I suppose in a way, the writing of the memoir was an act of helping me understand what happens to us, what we go through when we have near-death experiences, you know, when we come back from the brink, how it changes us, how we feel about it, you know. And I think these experiences always take up residence inside us. You know, we're different people afterwards. We're wiser, we're a little bit sadder, I think. But also we value what we have. You know, I think it makes us think about why we need to stay, what we value. And so my daughter was diagnosed quite young with an immune disorder. And so she does have chronic eczema. She was born with chronic eczema, which has been so severe, it's actually been life-threatening for her because it's turned into sepsis. And she also gets a lot of quite serious respiratory infections. And she also has very, very severe allergies, which put her into anaphylactic shock quite repeatedly. So it is something. But I always say to her, you know, everybody has something. Everybody is challenged by something. It may not be as visible as eczema. It may not be as dramatic as anaphylaxis, but people are struggling with something always, and you have to remember that. And I say to her, you live with very strict parameters, but I do as well. You know, there's lots of stuff I can't do because of certain neurological overhangs from my illness as a child. I said, you know, but what we all have to do is to live the biggest and the best life we can within whatever strictures our life sets out for us.
So being sick as a child gave you clues about how to comfort your child?
Well, I think so. I don't know. I mean, I think there is a comfort in it. I think partly the book for me was also a revelation to me about the human need for narrative, how we all need stories and we need to hear about experiences and we need to translate them into a story. Because I found that when, you know, dealing with a child, a very young child who was sick and suffering an awful lot with physical discomfort and fear and these quite terrifying experiences of anaphylaxis, you know, because going through anaphylaxis is, I can imagine, I've never been, but I can imagine having watched somebody, it's terrifying. You know, your airways close in and your heart rate dips and you can feel your body turning against you, you know, your life's blood and your breath and your heart. That is terrifying to live through that, experience that happening to yourself. And I found that the only way to help her understand it is to tell her a story. So I almost transpose it into a fairy tale. And I say to her, once upon a time, there was a little girl who had dragons and she loved her dragons so much, but sometimes the dragons hugged her too tightly and she couldn't breathe. And I would just say this stuff to her and she would listen and she would absolutely focus. And it was a way, in a sense, that she could comprehend it. She could understand it. And so I realised that trying to comfort her or trying to be her mum revealed to me our need to hear stories about ourselves and about others, which is why I wrote the book.
How old is she now?
She's 8.
Did being sick as a child yourself lead you to become a reader and a writer?
It's difficult for me to dissociate who I would have been without being ill. I don't know whether I would still be a writer if I hadn't been ill. It's hard. You know, I don't have a huge sense of who I was before I became very seriously ill. But I do know that the experience of being a young child in hospital turns you into a very strongly observant person. In order to glean information and to find out what's happening, you have to learn to interpret and to watch with hawk-like attention how the people around you are behaving, how your parents are feeling, what you can pick up from their facial expressions or their reactions to doctors or nurses. And I think that fed directly into being a writer, certainly. But I think the other thing, I mean, I've always really believed that to be a writer, you need to first be a reader. And, you know, I was in hospital, I was unable to move for quite a long time. And while I lay in the hospital bed, somebody lent me a large tape player with some story tapes. So I listened to those tapes over and over and over and over again. I mean, I knew them off by heart. And then when I could actually physically hold a book, when my hands were able to do that, that's all I did for over a year, because I was off school for all that time. And so I would read from one end of my bookshelf to the other end, and then when I finished I would start again. But I think what happens is actually that if you spend that much time alone in bed just reading, what you do is you develop this kind of, obviously it's a very nascent sort of critical sense, but you know, when you first read a book for maybe the first one or two times, you're reading it for plot, you're reading it to find out what happens. But I think subsequent readings after that, I found myself thinking, you know, why does Tove Jansson start this chapter with dialogue? Why doesn't she start with Once Upon a Time or They Were Sitting in the Kitchen? And what difference does that make? You know, I think you do start to have a sort of 9-year-old thoughts about that kind of thing. And you start to think about why the writer has chosen to do it this way. Why does she change tense here? You know, and I think in a sense that certainly made me a writer as well, because I still do that now. You know, I still, like a mechanic, will take apart an engine to see how it works. I will do the same with a book that I really like or admire.
Well, Maggie O'Farrell, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Maggie O'Farrell's new memoir is called I Am, I Am, I Am, 17 Brushes with Death. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has been reading some newly reprinted novels from the Harlem Renaissance. She says these novels about American racism hardly feel dated at all.
To mark Black History Month, Penguin Press is reprinting 6 early 20th century books by African-American writers. The 5 Harlem Renaissance novels, along with W.E.B. Du Bois's 1903 masterwork, The Souls of Black Folk, are much more than a summons to readerly duty. Rather, they're a shake-up and wake-up call, reminding readers of the vigorous voices of earlier African-American writers, each of whom had their own ingenious take on the race problem and identity politics. With a respectful nod, I'm going to bypass Du Bois's monumental essay collection, along with Harlem Renaissance superstars Claude McKay and Langston Hughes, in favor of 3 remaining revelatory novels by somewhat less celebrated writers. Nella Larson, the only female writer featured here, makes the cut with her 1929 novel, Passing. It's a page-turner, premised on an idea that's discussed a lot these days, the idea of race as performance. Larson's 2 main characters are upper-middle-class Black women who knew each other back in the day and have been thrown together again by fate. Both women are light-skinned, but one of them, Claire Kendry, has chosen to climb up the class ladder by passing as white. At one point, Claire's clueless white husband says in conversation, "I don't dislike Negroes, I hate them." Of course, the joke there is that he makes that boast while talking with 2 Black women, one of whom is his wife. In her sharp introduction to this edition of Passing, scholar Emily Bernard illuminates Larson's own experience with the color line. Larson was the daughter of a Danish mother and a West Indian father. passing is undeniably melodramatic, but it's infused with a sly humor and nervous awareness that Claire's daily act of performing whiteness will inevitably take a devastating toll. Passing is not an option for Wallace Thurman's heroine in The Blacker the Berry. Emma Lou Morgan is so dark, she thinks of herself as dipped in indigo. The Blacker the Berry stirred up a hullabaloo when it came out in 1929 because it was the first novel to focus its plot on race prejudice or colorism among African Americans. Always hoping to find a more inclusive racial community, Emma Lou takes off to Los Angeles for college and then on to New York and Harlem. But everywhere she goes, lighter-skinned Black women, the so-called blue veins, get exclusive access to the desirable sororities, jobs, and potential husbands. Thurman, whose literary career was cut short when he died of tuberculosis at 32, creates a complicated character in Emma Lou. By the time she arrives in Harlem, Emma Lou has realized her dark skin makes marriage unlikely, so she does something startling. She enjoys a series of sexual relationships without commitment or shame. Apart from the vibrant character of Emma Lou, Thurman's novel presents some of the most layered portrayals of New York City life I've ever come across, from seedy employment agency waiting rooms to swank Harlem hotspots. The dedication page of George S. Schuyler's extraordinary 1931 work of speculative fiction called Black No More lets readers know that this is going to be a wild ride. Schuyler, who was Black, writes, "This book is dedicated to all Caucasians in the Great Republic who can trace their ancestry back 10 generations and confidently assert that there are no Black leaves, twigs, limbs, or branches on their family trees." Black No More is a satiric tour de force that rips into myths of white supremacy, Black nationalism, and the American dream. The story follows a Black man named Max Disher as he gambles on a new invention, the Black-off machine that turns Black folks white. Here's a jubilant Max after the procedure. Gone were the slightly full lips and Ethiopian nose. Gone was the nappy hair. He was free. The world was his oyster, and he had the open sesame of a pork-colored skin. Schuyler's own story is also the stuff of wild fiction. A fierce provocateur, he ended his life a member of the John Birch Society. All of these Harlem Renaissance novelists forged their art within what Du Bois famously called the double consciousness of African Americans. That is, to be an American, a Negro. Two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body, whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder. These writers transform an understanding of the double consciousness with the expression of a third consciousness they own, as stirring, singular artists controlling their narrative and projecting it into a cacophonous world.
Maureen Corrigan reviewed three reprinted novels from the Harlem Renaissance, which are part of a series from Penguin Classics. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Jordan Klepper, the creator and host of Comedy Central's satirical political series, The Opposition, which is on right after The Daily Show. He hosts the show in character as a far-right commentator whose views are in sync with Breitbart News and Alex Jones's InfoWars. Here's Klepper on the premiere episode last September.
I know why you're here. You're here because you've noticed that all mainstream media sounds the same. You keep hearing the same talking points, peddled by the same people, who are all controlled by the same elite puppet masters. It's why they all agree on certain facts. Like climate change is man-made. President Trump lost the popular vote. I can't park there. That's how they operate. That's how they smuggle their dangerous ideas across the open borders of your mind. I want to shut down those borders. I want to close your mind. It's called mental nationalism. And it's an idea whose time has come. That's why here at the opposition, we believe in our own golden rule. May you only hear from others what you've already been telling yourself.
The opposition also has other commentators who are called citizen journalists. The show ends each night with Klepper interviewing a guest, typically a politician, actor, journalist, or social activist. Klepper got his start in improv and sketch comedy. In 2014, he became a correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, where his persona was often the clueless white guy. He stayed on The Daily Show after Trevor Noah became the host until Klepper started the opposition. Let's hear Klepper's commentary from last Wednesday night about Trump's announcement that he wants to have a military parade.
Trump's a go-getter. He sees things he likes, he goes, and then he gets them. He sees the presidency, he gets it. He sees a military parade in France, he gets it. He sees a woman he hasn't married, he gets it. He sees an onion ring on his pillowcase, he gets it. And this parade idea is awesome, period, end. But leave it to liberals to hear about a parade and start forecasting rain.
We don't need to show off our military might like countries like North Korea or Russia.
We have a Napoleon in the making here. Everyone should be offended by his need to always be showing. He's truly Napoleon-like.
Oh, my God. Will you stop with the Napoleon references already? Napoleon was a narcissistic misogynist with weird hair and multiple wives who lived in an extravagant, ornate tower. He's nothing like Trump.
Jordan Klepper, welcome to Fresh Air. It is a great pleasure to have you here. So I'm going to ask you...
Thanks for having me, Terry.
You are so welcome. I'm going to ask you to describe your character on the show.
Well, I think you heard that idea of mental nationalism, which feels like, to me, it feels like this time and this place that we're living right now where we only want to hear those things we already believe to be true. And so this character, Jordan Klepper, on this show embodies that. He is somebody that only trusts himself. He's an opportunist. He's egotistical. He has privilege, but he doesn't understand that he has that privilege. And he's looking to be the center of attention and the victim in every situation. He creates his own reality.
And he believes in some conspiracy theories.
Indeed, he does. He definitely sees the spaces. He sees the two dots, and he fills the spaces with the things that make him feel more comfortable. I think he's constantly paranoid. I think deep down it's because he knows there's a lot of stuff he doesn't know, but he won't admit that to himself. So he fills that in with this sense of paranoia. He connects the dots with something that's much more interesting than the real truth that actually exists out there.
I was in New York shortly before the show started, and there were bus ads that were really hilarious. And it was a picture of you, and the caption was, "There's hydrogen in the water." Like, that was so great because it sounds like, uh-oh, wow, there's hydrogen in the water. I should be scared. And then you realize, by definition, there is hydrogen in H2O. But it was such a great example of how you can start a conspiracy theory about something when there's nothing wrong.
Exactly. I think science to some people is already scary. So we are using that as a weapon in that situation. But I think what we had a lot of fun with in creating both those billboards and building that show were like, you could scare people with half-truths. You could even scare people with truths because people react to fear. All across town, you saw that China wasn't real. You saw that the mail knows where you live. And you definitely saw that there was hydrogen in the water.
You know, so much of the far right stuff, it's in code. And like, even when Alex Jones introduces his show, it's like from deep in the heart of FEMA Region 6. So how FEMA Region 6 figures into it, I have no idea. Can you tell me?
Well, it sounds evocative. It sounds like something you don't fully understand. And when you don't fully understand something, you have to take somebody at their word. And then that word may become something about gay frogs, and suddenly you're already down a conspiracy rabbit hole. So I think, like, Americans love a good conspiracy. We want there to be something we cannot see. And so I think even this idea of deep state is so evocative. Like, we want to know more about it. Like, something is being hidden from us. I want to be in on the know.
Okay, so since we've mentioned Alex Jones, before your show even went on the air, Alex Jones was talking to his listeners about it because he had read that your character was going to be partially modeled on him. So in your first episode, you played two clips, one of him just talking about Hillary and another of him talking about you. So I want to play that excerpt from the first edition of The Opposition. And you're talking about how one of your allies in the fight against mainstream media is Alex Jones.
We have to mention another ally in this fight. Alex Jones of InfoWars. Now, this man is a full glistening slab of Texas truth. And don't take my word for it, just listen.
I can tell you 100%, the Clintons have had vacations in Haiti. They've visited voodoo priests. They've spent weeks in voodoo churches. They practice demon possession. That's what voodoo is, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. I can tell you're right, Alex, because you growled it at me. See, it takes a crazy amount of voodoo to both win and lose a presidential election. Now, Jones is a raging bull of truth. His whole show, total bull, and I respect that. Which is why, it's why this broke my heart so hard.
You know why they hate me? You know why they now have an entire new Comedy Central show with their comedian, quote, playing the part of Alex Jones? And they will say things and do things every night that I haven't said or I haven't done to create branding with the type of mentally retarded people that believe and watch their channel. Again, I'm not making fun of the real people that are mentally retarded. I'm talking about people that have been induced into these comas. People need to understand, we have their plan. We know their plan.
Alex, no, 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 Alex, no. No, look, look. They are trying to divide us, but we can't let them. I don't know where you got that plan, but I promise you, it's not our plan.
So what was your reaction when you heard Alex Jones call your viewers, before you even had any, mentally retarded people who were induced into comas?
It's bold. I want him on our branding. I think immediately I'll click on that. It felt very classic Alex Jones. I think what I love about that clip, you can boil it down to the first part of how he introduced our show. He's like, you know, they hate me. Like, it's all about creating enemies. It's drawing a line. It's them versus us. They hate me. And I am under attack. We are under attack. Look at these people. They're coming at us. For us, that's sort of how we approach every story. And Alex Jones constantly does that. He's tribal. He plays into the worst parts of tribalism. It's us versus them. And he looks to just create enemies that he can immediately go at. And so, I mean, I was touched that he chose us.
So you created this like website called If You Are Alex Jones, Click This, If Not, Don't.com. And on that website, you lay out your plan. And the plan is, find out what people are scared of. Make people even more scared of those things. Develop products that protect people against those things. Sell those products that protect people against those things. Sell those products to the people who are scared. Get rich as hell.
It's a good plan.
It's a good plan, yeah. So when you were in high school, I think it was, you were on the mock trial team. I'm not sure what that is, but you can tell me what it is and then tell me if it helped you prepare for this kind of like deconstruction, the logical creation of illogical arguments.
A mock trial is sort of like an even nerdier version of debate. You put on a faux trial. We pretend to be witnesses, pretend to be attorneys. You're actually working with real attorneys and doing it in front of actual judges. So it's like part play, part Menendez trial. So it's exactly what a young 15-year-old wants to be doing, which is like stay up all night both preparing a play and working with real-life attorneys to figure out how a voir dire works. And so I was kind of drawn to that in high school because I was a nerd. I thought at the time that I wanted to be an attorney. I quickly realized, oh, what I liked about this wasn't the law. It was like showboating. So it took me a while to figure that out. With that took me into college, which I got into math. And I think, like, I've always had somewhat of an analytical brain. And it wasn't until I got into the comedy world where I got to use those kinds of mechanics to break down news stories and the ways in which you can kind of attack something through comedy.
So I first heard you on The Daily Show, and I want to play your very first appearance on The Daily Show, and this was the Jon Stewart era. You were supposed to be reporting from Crimea, which was then part of Ukraine, but had just been invaded by Russian troops claiming it as Russian land. And Ukraine's authoritarian president, Viktor Yanukovych, had just been ousted. So here you are on The Daily Show, supposedly reporting from Crimea. And it starts with Jon Stewart.
For more on the story, we're joined by our new senior Caucasian correspondent, Jordan Klepper. Jordan, thank you for joining us on the program. We appreciate you. Jordan, welcome to the show, first of all. We're excited to have you. You are in Crimea. Obviously, you have studied this region for years.
Yes, that is 100% true. Okay, as you know, the Crimean Peninsula is ethnically Russian. Mm-hmm. Now, it's important to remember a peninsula is a landmass surrounded on three sides by water, unlike an island or an isthmus. Now, the Crimean Peninsula is dependent on Russia for most of their natural resources.
Actually, they're dependent on the Ukraine for most of their natural resources.
Right. Right. Stupid. Stupid. I'm sorry. I don't know why I said that. I'm not going to fail you, Dad. John.
It's all right, Jordan. It's fine.
Okay.
Just relax. How are the people feeling?
They're scared, John. Real scared. A little sweaty.
Because they have ties to both the Ukraine and Russia? Is that...
Sure. I mean, if you'd asked them a week ago, would you like to be a part of Russia? They would have been like, yes, Russia's my favorite. I'd love to join Russia. I watch Russia every night. But now they don't know what they've gotten themselves into, you know, and they think, maybe I've gotten a little bit in over my head.
Look, just say, it's fine. You're doing fine. Stay focused. What have you learned so far today?
You have to dial 9 to get an outside line. Lunch is at 1. And if I keep my head down here for a couple of years, I've got a real shot at my own sitcom on NBC.
It was Jordan Klepper's first appearance on The Daily Show. Whose idea was for your first sketch on The Daily Show to be about how nervous you were on The Daily Show?
I think that was John's idea. Although I'd like to say that I brought being nervous to The Daily Show myself. So I think if he was reading the room, it started with me.
How nervous were you?
I was nervous, but I couldn't be more excited. Like, that brings back a ton of memories. I remember walking in that day, and I had gotten the call 3 days earlier that I should show up on Monday and bring my suit because I might be on the show, and it was a dream come true. And I walk in, they usher me into John's office, and they're like, this Crimea story took place. We're gonna do a story about this. And at that point, I'm like, this is my first day at the job. I couldn't be more excited, nervous, and they're talking about Crimea. I don't know anything about Crimea. I want to be a part of this conversation, but boy, I need to get to a Google fast. And so we started building this piece around it. And throughout the day, we continued to write it. I remember that dad joke was my first joke I got on the show. There's no better feeling than improvising in a room on your first day than Jon Stewart liking that joke and it becoming part of the final piece.
So you were first introduced as the new senior Caucasian correspondent, and your identity was often the clueless white guy. Why was that your persona?
You know, I don't know what it is about me that people see a clueless white guy. It's a difficult role for me to get into. It is something with comedy. It's like, what do people read and what do they see with you? But I definitely came in there. I think what I bring and what I've always had fun doing is, like, you play these pompous, heightened characters who have these big blind spots. And I think, like, it's a type of character I've played before. And I think, like, adding the racial element of it, it gives it a little bit more, I think, a little bit more punch and more reality to it. I think people look at me, and if I'm honest, they look like, oh, there's that guy. That guy gets everything handed to him. Oh, and he's more confident than he should be. And he acts like he's smarter than he really is. Screw that guy. So it's like, if that's what people see, let me play around with that, heighten it, and hopefully we can find comedy there.
So you grew up in Kalamazoo, Michigan. When I was growing up, what I knew about Kalamazoo was the song, the Glenn Miller recording, I Got a Girl in Kalamazoo.
Yeah. I Got a Gal in Kalamazoo.
I Got a Gal in Kalamazoo. Yeah. So did that recording kind of stay with you? Was that popular in Kalamazoo? Like, how do the people of Kalamazoo feel about that record?
I mean, I think as a kid, any reference to Kalamazoo felt special. So I knew about that song. I can't say I was big into Glenn Miller era swing music when I was 12, but I knew that there was a song that referenced Kalamazoo that made us cool. I think a Creedence Clearwater Revival referenced Kalamazoo in a song as well. That made me feel very cool. Like, whenever it popped up on any kind of pop culture spectrum, people from Kalamazoo owned it and loved it because it has this funny, weird, mystical sounding name. Mm-hmm. Even our town slogan is, "Yes, there really is a Kalamazoo,"
which I didn't love. Know that.
It's like defensive. It's like, we get it. You don't think we're real, but trust us. It's a real place, I assure you.
That sounds like good preparation for a conspiracy theorist.
I think it is. I feel like it's one of those details when I tell people I'm from Kalamazoo, they're like, "Oh, that's a fake name." It's like, no, that's real. It's like, oh, but this is the world. We don't trust anything anymore. If it sounds fake, it might just be.
Do you ever wish that you were not on at 11:30 opposite Colbert and Fallon and Kimmel? And, you know, Conan O'Brien's on then, too. And, like, most of the late-night comics now are starting with political comedy. And I keep thinking, like, shouldn't somebody be on at, like, 10 or 10:30? I mean, Samantha Bee's on at 10:30. But, like, can't we just, like, rearrange the schedule a little bit so, like, everybody's not on at the same time? I know we can all DVR or watch it on the internet. Nevertheless, I think I'm asking a very rational question here.
It's a very rational. I will go directly to the network and be like, "Guys, there's a lot of people out at 11:30. If we could just bump that up a little bit." I will say what's also so interesting now is news breaks so late in the day.
I know.
It's so funny. I feel like all these late night shows, we're waiting and we're in rewrite at like 5:45, getting ready to like send our things to graphics so we can hopefully tape at 6:30 or 7. And news breaks and you got to throw it out and try to write something new. So you almost benefit by pushing it as late as you can. It's as close to the next day as you can get before the show starts is emblematic of this news cycle just does not end. We need all the time of the day we can get in order to comment on what's already happening.
Jordan Klepper, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Terry, thank you.
Jordan Klepper hosts Comedy Central's satirical political show, The Opposition. It's on right after The Daily Show.